is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. In the previous hour, we had Julio Rivera on debating with me whether we should hold the Sackler family and Purdue Pharma criminally liable. He agreed with me. And so I said, well, then should, you know, because they lied to the American people and they sold a product that was killing people. And I said, well, then how about the fossil fuel industry? And at that point, it was like, whoa, no. But it was an interesting conversation. Senator Jeff Merkley dropped by and announced that he is not going to run for president. He's going to stay in the United States Senate and fight the good fight. He's, my senator, one of my two senators from Oregon, and really one of the good guys in Congress. And I was raising the question, is it time to stop oppressing the supermajority? And this from a piece of today's New York Times where Tim Wu points out that while Congress is doing nothing on any of these issues, well, actually, the Senate, the Republican-controlled Senate is doing nothing on any of these issues. The democratically-controlled House is actually passing legislation right now on all of these issues. But here's what he says. About 75% of Americans favor higher taxes for the ultra-wealthy. Paid maternity leave, 67% support. 83% support for net neutrality. Over 60% stronger privacy laws, 71% think we should be able to buy drugs imported from Canada, 92% want Medicare to negotiate lower drug prices and so on, and none of that is happening because of Republican obstruction. Now, why is that happening? We're not happening because of Republican obstruction? Because the Republicans are owned by right-wing billionaires and the corporations that made them billionaires. It really just comes right down to that. His article is titled The Oppression of the Supermajority. And so anyhow, we've been talking about those things, and those are still on the topic table, as it were. But I wanted to move along to a couple of other things. Denise Grady writing in the New York Times earlier this week that studies of a deadly form of the flu virus are going to resume. They were paused. They were suspended in 2014. This is research where they take a flu virus that may already be deadly and mutate it to make it more deadly so that we can figure out what are the things that make it more or less deadly and how can we create perhaps even a vaccine, an immunization against it. Because, you know, the last time we had a truly deadly mutation of the flu, it happened on a pig farm, on a hog farm in Kansas in 1917, and spread all around the world as it was called the Spanish flu. But that was because troops from, you know, they were provisioning them and training them in Kansas near this hog farm, and they were getting their meat from there, and those troops were catching this flu, and before they had a chance to get highly symptomatic, they were being shipped off to Europe for World War I. And many of them went to Spain, and the flu went boom all across Europe, and then, you know, they came back to the United States, and it killed millions of people. And so these two research teams, one's in Wisconsin and the other is in Holland in the Netherlands, they had been, by our government and the Dutch government, they had been ordered to stop their research in 2014. And now they're being allowed to restart that research. And because apparently they've come up with protocols to deal with these viruses in ways, you know, the main concern was that they would develop a superbug and then it would get out. You know, one of the researchers would get accidentally contaminated and go home and their family would get it. And, you know, before anybody knew it, boom, it's out in the wild. Or that the virus itself might be being transported or something like that, and it might get out. And those are legitimate concerns. But they think that they've got that nailed down. But I've got a larger concern here, and I think it's a really important one. And that is, without a national health care system, with over 30 million people in the United States being uninsured, and another 100 million people having such crappy insurance with such high deductibles and co-pays, that they tend not to go to the doctor when they should, we are sitting ducks for, you know, a flu epidemic or frankly, any kind of epidemic of a deadly disease. We're just sitting here waiting for it to happen. And, you know, I think that in the context of this, you know, the possibility of deadly pandemics, you know, epidemics that are worldwide, Other countries can deal with that. They have national health care systems. Mexico can deal with it. Canada can deal with it. Costa Rica can deal with it. Ecuador can deal with it. I think Colombia can deal with it. But we can't, because we've got all these uninsured and underinsured people, people who fundamentally lack access to health care for anything other than screaming emergencies. And they, and typically when you get the flu at first, you don't think of it as a screaming emergency. It's a huge inconvenience and you feel terrible and you can't work for a few days. But, you know, most people get through it. But they won't get through one of these deadly flus, and they won't get through, and they wouldn't get through the bird flu of 1918. In fact, there's even concern now that some of the graveyards, this was, there was, you know, we talked about this on this program, I think it was a year or so ago. It was in the spring, and you know, as climate change is continuing, and it can get far more aggressive, the farther north you are, the more rapidly the atmosphere is heating. Right, the atmosphere has heated by 5 or 6 degrees Fahrenheit up in the Arctic, whereas it's only it's a little less than 1 degree at the equator. So you know, the closer you get to the poles, the more rapidly climate change is happening. And I'm not sure if that's true of the South Pole as it is the North Pole, and if it has to do with the tilt of the Earth or what. I'm not sure exactly why that is. And it would be a good question to put to Michael Mann, but that is the situation. And so what was happening, and we talked about this, like I said, on the program about a year ago, was that there were these graves in the northern parts of Europe and in central Scandinavia where people were buried during the winter with the Spanish flu. And, you know, they broke the ground and they got them into nearly frozen ground or frozen ground and they got buried and the ground froze and it never thawed out. And so it was like a deep freeze refrigerator, and now that ground is thawing out. And in fact, in some cases, the ground is liquefying. It's got so much moisture in it, you know, that has been ice for thousands of years and now it's turning to water. And so it's turning into something that kind of resembles quicksand. And because the coffins are filled with air, in addition to a dead body, these coffins are just rising up to the surface. And, these bodies of people who died from the flu, where the flu virus that infected them may still be viable, are starting to appear. I mean, we could see a repeat of the flu of 1918, and we have no national healthcare system for this, which takes us back to Tim Wu's piece in the New York Times. And the question that I was asking in the last hour is, you know, when are we going to start doing the will of the supermajority, the vast majority, more than two-thirds of Americans? And when are we going to stop listening to the idiots on network television who sit around, you know, these pundits who sit on these so-called panels for people who you know, frankly, should be reporting the news, but instead they're taking one story and saying, oh, let me get my panel on here and we'll talk about this for 5 minutes and we'll get the opinion of a Republican and a conservative Democrat and we'll try to pretend that we're not actually, you know, it's pathetic. The whole panelization of news, and we're not hearing about this. And you know, 75% of Americans want higher taxes on the ultra wealthy. When was the last time you heard a panel discussion about that? At least one that didn't ridicule it, as Tim Wu points out. 67% of Americans want guaranteed paid maternity leave. Every other developed country in the world has this. We don't. The state of Washington does. Governor Jay Inslee made sure that happened up there. But the rest of the country, nah, sorry. 83% of us want net neutrality. No conversation. No conversation in the media, much less in Congress. 60% of us want stronger privacy laws in the context of that. And, you know, of course, you would apply that to things like Facebook. We're now finding out that Facebook, apparently, if you have two-step authentication, you know, where you give them your phone number so that when you sign in, you put your password in, and then they send you a code to your phone, and you plug in the code so that they know for sure that it's you and you haven't been hijacked, that that, of course, they're taking your phone number and using it. You know, what are they giving it to their advertisers? Are they selling it? Are they using it to, you know, other people can search for it? I mean, it's, and you can't turn it off. You can restrict it to your friends, but not to, but you can't turn it off. It's bizarre. So 60% of us would like stronger privacy laws. 71% of us think we should be able to buy drugs from Canada. I mentioned a couple days ago the one medication that I do take, that's now like $100 a month for me, I can buy from Canada for less than $20 a month. And it's the exact same drug made in the exact same factory over in Hyderabad, India. 92% of us want Medicare to be able to negotiate lower drug prices. And yet, we're not hearing any conversation about any of these things in our media, and we're not hearing any action on any of these things coming out of Congress. And this, in my opinion, is an actual crisis. This is fueling anger on the part of average Americans. And Donald Trump in 2016 tapped into that anger. He said to Americans, you know, the system is rigged. And all across America, people were going, you bet your butt it is. You know, I want Medicare for all. And Donald Trump said, we're going to basically give it to you. He said, we're going to do away with Obamacare and replace it with something that is better, that's universal, that's less expensive. Well, you know, the only thing that I know of that beats that criteria is Medicare for all, single-payer health care. Now, or some variation thereof, one of the European systems. Donald Trump promised us that. He got elected based on that promise. Now, yeah, he lost the election by 3 million votes, but he won the Electoral College based on that promise. He said he was going to bring our jobs home. Now it looks like the whole thing with China, he's going to announce some grand victory in the next week or so, and it's going to be a scam. It's a Potemkin village. It's a phony baloney thing. It's a city made out of cardboard that's painted to look like a city, sort of thing. And you know that's coming. So, what is it going to take? And the reason, of course, and Tim Wu identifies this in the New York Times, the reason why Congress doesn't pass these things is because they're owned by these giant corporations. I would add the reason why the media doesn't talk about these things is, A, they don't want to offend the Republican Party, because their whole model is having Republicans come on and talk, and B, many of these companies are their advertisers.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, you know, what do you think about all this? What can we do about this? I've offered some suggestions. I think there are others. We'll pick up your calls after this. And welcome back. Carol in Manassas, Pennsylvania, watching us on Free Speech TV. Hey, Carol, what's on your mind today?
Hey, you had to scare me to death. My husband and I had just watched Stephen King's The Stand about the super flu.
Oh, really? I didn't even know he'd written a book about that.
Oh, you got to read it. It's great. The Stand, STAND.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, it kills off just about everybody. But that's been my fear for a long time with not having a national health care program. I mean, it's just an epidemic or a pandemic waiting to happen is what it is.
Yeah, and this is a national security issue, Carol.
Absolutely. I mean, I've talked to people recently this winter about, you know, did you get your flu shot? No, I can't afford it. I don't have the money.
Wow.
And it is expensive. I mean, I'm on Medicare, uh-huh, as I believe you are.
Yeah.
And I still, in order to get the one that gives you an immune booster, which you can get,
mm-hmm,
and doesn't have all the bad stuff in it.
That's right. Yeah, you can get the double dose. It's twice as much dead flu virus and no aluminum, which is called an adjuvant, none of the stuff that jacks your immune system in ways that are unpredictable and can cause autoimmune diseases, in my humble opinion.
That's the word. That's the word I was looking for. But I got that this year because in 1997, I got the flu. I didn't get a flu shot that year.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sick from Thanksgiving until February.
Wow.
I thought I was going to die. And after that, I was first in line for the flu shot.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
I can afford it. That's the problem. I can afford it.
Yeah,
so many people cannot. And that's a sin and a shame.
Yep. I agree. And, you know, I have concerns about the way that they manufacture and market vaccines, but vaccines work. And, you know, we did away with polio, we did away with smallpox. Yep. You know, we can deal with flu, and particularly now that they have a flu vaccine that's specifically designed for older people, but, you know, younger people may be able to get it, that does not have any aluminum in it. You know, so it doesn't mess with your immune system. It just has more of the virus. Louise and I are like, here's our arm. Give us the shot.
Exactly. Yeah. I'd take four of them if I could.
Yeah, there you go.
May I say one more thing real quickly before I go?
Certainly. We have 50 seconds before we hit the break.
I saw Jay Inslee last night on Rachel's show.
So did I.
What an impressive man he is.
Yes.
Climate change is his number one priority, and he has my vote just on that alone.
Yeah. And he's been beating that drum for 20 years. I mean, this is not something new for James Inslee. Jay Inslee.
He's been a great governor, too.
Yeah, he really has.
Well, thank you for letting me rant on.
my pleasure, Carol. Thank you very much for the call.
Bye-bye.
It's great to hear from you. Thank you, and thanks for watching us on Free Speech TV. And that's a point. I mean, this, you would think that you could even have this conversation with Republicans, right? This is a national security issue. I mean, what if it wasn't the flu? What if Kim Jong-un decided that he was going to take out America, and the way he was going to do it was he was going to release some, you know, pneumonic plague or something, some new strain of a disease that's highly contagious. The pneumonic form of the plague doesn't require fleas. It's transmitted by coughing, right? Thus, P-N-E-N-U, however you spell pneumonic, you know, as in having to do with the lungs, and like pneumonia, you know. And it's a real disease. We're not ready for that kind of. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Dave in Federal Way, Washington. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind?
Hey, not too much, Tom. No, this is a great topic. Climate change is a big driver of a lot of this. And I know, like in November 2017, thereabout, the longhorn, what they call the Asian longhorn tick, is now on the continental United States.
Yeah, it's the longhorn beetle you're talking that kills the trees. But there's also ticks are moving as a consequence of climate change.
Yes, no, I was specifically talking about the tick, Haemophysalis longicornis is its scientific name. But it is it carries Abunia viralis. And what made me think about that is, okay, even though it is, all right, the hantavirus is a member of that group, the Abunia viralis.
Yeah, and for people who don't know what we're talking about, the hantavirus is a virus that's transmitted by the urine of rodents. And it's a real problem down in the South and the Southwest, the kind of Texas, Arizona South, because you can inhale this stuff and get that virus, and it can kill you.
Yeah, and it's the only one of that virus group that is airborne.
Right.
And when I was in Korea, when I was stationed in Korea, unfortunately, I worked with this young kid who was a ROK Marine, Republic of Korea Marine, when I was doing some special operations stuff. And we were around helicopters a lot. Well, this, it's an airborne. The hantavirus is airborne. Well, he contracted Korean hemorrhagic fever, which is also a variant. But this kid's 23 years old in excellent physical shape. The doctors were bragging that they kept him alive for like 36 hours. Okay, this is extremely, deadly.
The family of hemorrhagic viruses, that includes Ebola, right?
Yeah, it does. It does include Ebola. And, you know, we have Fort Detrick, okay, and we have, the U.S. Army medical research, but all that is reactive. To your point, we don't really have a proactive system. I mean, okay, it sounds great that we're state-of-the-art, we can react to any deadly pathogen, but think about that. Think about, like I said, that kid lasted 32 hours.
Yeah.
All right. I mean, you really need to think about it. Do you really want to brag about being reactive? Yeah. Something like that. I mean,
yeah, and we are unprepared for a pandemic. I mean, you know, if a country that decided to go to war with us, you know, North Korea, for example, or you know, any country, was to drop some sort of a airborne disease in the United States, we've got basically 100 million, you know, about a third of our population who are unwilling to go to the doctor unless they're at death's door because they can't afford the copays. And that's nuts. We need a national healthcare system. It's a national security issue. Dave, excellent points. Thanks so much for calling and making them. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
But, you know, that's just one piece of it. The majority of us want higher taxes on the ultra-wealthy. We want Social Security strengthened. We want all these things, and we're getting none of them, because of these right-wingers. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Sean, can I tell that story? Sean just got a call, somebody left a message on her phone saying that that her Social Security number had been compromised, and if she didn't call them immediately, it may be canceled or rendered inoperable or whatever the phrase is, suspended, excuse me. And yesterday, Louise got a call from somebody saying that they were with Social Security, and they were calling about her husband's pain, and she came off in search of me, and I was like, this is a scam, and they, oh yes, this is the Social Security Assistance Administration. And a woman with a fairly thick Filipino accent, I'm guessing she was literally calling from the Philippines. They run these boiler rooms in India and in the Philippines. These are scams. And if you get a call like this, just know the Social Security Administration does not call people. Period. If they want to communicate with you, they will send you a letter. And the scammers tend not to send the letters because, you know, they can get nailed with that. It's a lot harder to get nailed with a phone call. So anyhow, and other news, this fascinating. Peter DeFazio, an old buddy of mine, and Brian Schatz, I'm not sure. I think it's Schatz of Hawaii. They want to put a 0.1% tax on all stock, bond, and derivative trades. Now, we had this from the 1930s to the 1960s. It was called the STET tax, the Securities Transaction Excise Tax, and it kept the stock market stable. They're suggesting that this could create as much as $77 billion in revenue a year. And the news release that they put out, a tiny tax on Wall Street trades can make a big change. Slowing down high-speed computer trading will calm our markets. Taxing speculation will refocus trading on long-term job-creating investments. And taxing trade at a rate of just 10 cents on every $100 traded will stack up to big money that can rejuvenate American communities. It's time for all members of Congress to call to rebuild Main Street on Wall Street's dime. That's from Lisa Gilbert, the Vice President of Legislative Affairs for Public Citizen. But it's good stuff, and it's coming out of, you know, two, of course, Democrats in the House of Representatives, Brian Schatz of Hawaii. I'm sorry, he's in the Senate. Brian Schatz in the Senate and Peter DeFazio in the House of Representatives. So, they're calling it the Wall Street Tax Act of 2019. So if you want to call your member of Congress and give it a pitch, 202-225-3121. John in Boston. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good.
You're channeling me today, man. And it's, I mean, you do it every day. But
John, I need your mouth closer to your microphone, please.
I'm sorry, man. Can you hear me better now?
Yeah, it's a little bit better.
Okay, just a little bit? All right. I'm sorry about that. No, you're channeling me today. I mean, you do it every day, but and it ties into yesterday. You know, what do we do? Facts don't matter anymore. I mean, I'm sorry to say. And money controls Republicans and many others, the media, advertisers, lobbyists. So what do we do? I think it was Matt Taibbi a while ago, and it also ties in with the media, too. You say they're looking for a race and a competition. We need to take the meme from the Republicans, the whole USA, America number one. We have to come from a nationalistic approach, and you were doing it earlier, and we need to continue to do it.
And that's what the Green New Deal is, John.
Exactly.
It's literally, we're going to make America great again by rebuilding our energy infrastructure.
But here's the thing, Tom. People don't care about other countries. However, If you make it a competition and you were doing it brilliantly, oh, are you saying China is better than us? Are you saying China? At the beginning, you mentioned it and I've read it, into quantum technology. That's 22nd century. And we're still subsidizing 19th century technology. So we need to make it, like Matt Taibbi said, the media is all about competition. If we need to say we want to make America number one again, and you know, I mean, and then another part of that too is, you know, Trump said he believes Russia. That's the perfect bumper sticker. Trump believes Russia / Putin. Do you? I mean, we need to take it a nationalistic tone. Sorry to say it worked for the McCarthy and the other McCarthyism and so forth, but we wouldn't need to do it, you know, in a...
But, John, we don't need to do it. You know, the Republicans are doing it cynically because many of the things that they're proposing actually harm the United States, both short-term and long-term. You know, their tax cuts and their loyalty to fossil fuels, and they're wanting to destroy Medicare and Social Security and things like that. But they claim that it's going to make America better. We would be doing it with high integrity. We would actually be speaking the truth. These are things that actually will make America better. So, you know, I'm with you, John. I'm with you. And I hope our politicians are listening. John, thank you for the call. Brian in Schaumburg, Illinois. Hey, Brian, what's on your mind?
Hi, good afternoon. I'm an electrician. I live in the Midwest. You know, I'm a common sense kind of guy. And, you know, I hear you make the statement a lot about Germany going solar, and so I Googled it up and looked on Wikipedia while I was listening to you this morning, and some of the more current information I could find, I think it was on Wikipedia, more than half of Germany's energy is still coal, natural gas, and nuclear.
You're right.
In a very small percentage of it. Well, maybe a third of it is renewables, and it said that on some of the sunniest, windiest days, it can go as high as 3/4.
Well, actually, there were several days last summer where Germany was exporting electricity. They were producing over 100% of their entire national electric demands. But the way that they did it, and this is the lesson that I think America should figure out. The question that the Merkel government was facing. Well, I'm not even sure Angela Merkel was the leader at that time, because I think this was before I started doing this radio show. So I think this was around 2001, 2002. Because I gave a speech in Barcelona, Spain, with his name was Schmidt, one of the two German legislators who co-authored the legislation that they put into place. And what they were trying to do, they needed to build at least one, probably two new nuclear power plants in order to satisfy the growing energy demands of Germany. And they also wanted to start retiring the coal plants, you know, for green reasons and health reasons and everything else. And so they put together this two-step program where the government said that they would backstop banks, commercial banks. The government would 100% guarantee loans from commercial banks to people who owned more than 50% of the equity of their home or 25% of the equity of the home, whatever it was, but homeowners, to put solar panels on their roofs and tie them into the electric grid. And they would backstop that, these 10-year loans, and the loans would be amortized over a 10-year period. Then they also required the power companies, and I think these may be public utilities, although I'm not sure, Brian, and maybe you can Google it. But they said to the power companies, if you, power company, were to build these two nuclear power plants, over the course of a 10-year period, it would cost you about 7 times the retail cost of electricity. Now, you would amortize that over a longer period, you know, in terms of rate, you know, recovering it from rate increases and things and the expenses. But it would cost you about 7 times. So you pay the homeowners 7 times what your retail rate is. So if you're selling electricity to them at 10 cents a kilowatt hour, you buy electricity from them at 70 cents a kilowatt hour, and it's going to be the exact same expense to you as these two nuclear power plants would be, as I recall. And then the homeowners, since they're selling their electricity at this high, very high price and a profit, would be essentially selling electricity at a price that was at or even in many cases slightly above what the monthly mortgage payments were on the 10-year mortgage for the solar panels on their roofs. So at the end of 10 years, The homeowners own the solar system. It's completely paid off. It's been paid off by generating its own electricity, so it didn't cost them anything. The government backstopped it, so the banks didn't have any risk, so the loans were 1% and 2% loans because there was no risk associated with it. So the banks made some money on it. The homeowners end up with the solar system, and the average lifespan of a solar system in Germany, the ones that they were building out, was 50 years. So the original goal was 100,000 rooftops, and they ended up with millions. And like you said, it's like, you know, a third of the energy in Germany, and on a really good day in the summer, it was over 100% last year. You know, we did that story on this program.
Well, we
could do that here. I mean, this is not rocket science, Brian. This is not rocket science at all.
Well, could I just quickly add that we're always going to need a base power supply.
Sure.
There's no way we can go 100% renewable for various reasons. And here's
We can go 100% renewable because there are
batteries aren't there yet.
No, I'm not talking about it. There's all kinds of storage systems. You can have, you know, in Norway, their goal is to be 100% renewable within 20 years, and they're pumping water back up into, you know, up above dams when they're generating electricity during the day, and then they're drawing that water down through turbines at night to produce electricity. There's all kinds of ways to store power, number one. And number two, if you look at Texas and Iowa, both those states now are getting more than 20% of their electricity from renewable power, and the principal source in both those states is wind, and the wind blows all night long.
Here's Brian. The scenario I see. Hello?
Yeah.
Okay, being from the Midwest, we get many August days where it's very humid, not much wind, and then about 3 or 4 in the afternoon, the sky turns black because the thunderstorm's coming in. And everybody and their brother's got their air conditioner just cranking. Plus, all the commercial buildings and hospitals, that's a huge electric load.
You got about 10 seconds to make your point, Brad.
And it's just, I don't see how batteries can step in and provide power for a metropolitan area for 45 minutes.
With existing technology, you're right. And you know, my guess is that if we were to start there was a time, you know, when they were saying to the early car manufacturers in the 1890s, I don't see how you're ever going to get people to drive these things. There's no gas stations out in the, you know, in the far distant. You can't go anywhere. I mean, this is called technology. Brian, thanks for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I mean, Tesla just announced a new battery charger that can recharge, and, you know, can put a 150-mile charge on a Tesla in 30 minutes. That's a game changer. And welcome back. Al in Buffalo, New York, watching us on YouTube. Hey, Al, what's up?
Oh, my God. If NASA were to take the $19.2 billion that they used The Land Rover is no longer, you know, it hasn't been found. It's dead. So yeah. I think we should be focusing more. I read an article that said that there could be a possibility that we could do space solar power that gathers energy from sunlight in space.
Yeah.
And it transmits it wirelessly to Earth. I mean, why? I mean, if NASA is going to do, I mean, if NASA is going to do research in space, don't you think?
Well, and a lot of the research that they do in space, because they are power, you know, most satellites are actually powered by solar panels. So,
no, I'm talking about transmitting it.
I get that. But the transmission is kind of problematic so far. And again, technology changes. But a lot of NASA's technologies that were developed for space end up having practical applications here on Earth. Velcro is a great example. Forget about the $19 billion we spent on the rover. If we took the $300 billion that last year we gave to fossil fuel industries to subsidize them and gave that to NASA and said, okay, reinvent our energy systems,
it'd be offensive. There's almost 74,000 pages in our tax code, okay? And you just talked about the oil companies getting a lot of subsidies. It's not just the oil companies; it's NASA.
Yeah.
But we got to talk about the corporate churches too. That get a bunch. You know, they get the so-called 501c3, 501c4, and they get the grants and then the NRA. Then you get a lot of these. Believe it or not, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, you get a lot of these hate groups that are tax exempt.
That's correct.
And then, you know, Karl Rove's groups. You know, they, like Karl Rove has the GPS. He gets a nonprofit.
Yeah, we're subsidizing all of them.
The tax code is being ripped apart. I mean, it's like it's almost like Swiss cheese. It's just unfathomable that we can't rebuild our water and sewer distribution lines. The fact that, you know, like the guy from Boston, let's talk about that gas explosion, you know?
Yeah.
Because the gas infrastructure itself is deteriorating. And you know, I live in Buffalo here, you know, and they're repairing all the gas lines. And I you know, God knows if there's going to be another gas explosion like the one in Boston.
Sure.
But
all it takes
is
some serious frost heaves, you know, they disrupt the pipelines and things.
There's just so many things to worry about, Tom, and you're bringing all the good stuff up, but it's like, how do you keep sane? How do you keep a balance? You know, when every time you turn on the news, all you hear is
you look at all the positive opportunities out there, and you just push and push and push for them. I mean, we cannot give in to despair, Al. We cannot. The moment, this is exactly what they want. They want us to feel absolutely powerless. And the moment we surrender to that, we're cooked.
I think the Republicans are literally trying to break the will of the American people.
And
I think they've
absolutely
done. And that's all I can say. Donald Trump is just a symptom. I mean, we all created this Frankenstein.
Yep. I couldn't have said it better. Al, thank you very much.
Okay.
Spot on. It's coming up on 10 minutes before the hour. We're going to check in with Luke Vargas and find out what's going on in the world here with Talk Media News. So stick around. We'll be right back. So let's check in with Talk Media News to find out what's going on in the world today. This report brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com and Loving What You Do, Ellen Ratner's new book. On the line with us is the chief foreign correspondent for Talk Media News from UN headquarters in New York, Luke Vargas. You can hear his two-minute podcast every day by searching Luke Vargas wherever you get your podcasts. And, you know, pretty straightforward stuff. And, Luke, I understand that the that Trump has ended preferential trade status for Turkey and India. First of all, can you define preferential trade status? And secondly, what does this mean both in economic terms and political terms?
So this preferential trade status dates back to the 1970s. It's basically a trade policy which allows the U.S. to designate certain countries as deserving something of a reprieve from paying duties on exports to the United States. And the membership of this group of countries that enjoyed this benefit had traditionally been sort of based around whether they were a developing country or not. It was sort of a way of helping sort of less well-off countries, grow their economies without sort of paying the tariffs that wealthier countries would have to. And so India and Turkey and many other countries have been on this list for a long time. The reason each of them is being taken off is a little bit different, and it will affect them each in slightly different ways. I mean, India, the complaint here coming from the United States is that they've been passing various trade barriers that create negative effect for American companies. And it sort of boils down to, hey, you're a big enough country now, you can just pay for this. But I think there's a deeper frustration here on the U.S. side. India hasn't been fully compliant with the American efforts to stop doing business with Venezuela, buying some of their oil. Also with Iran, has not been fully compliant. You know, they haven't been completely towing the line on, dissociating economic purchases of Iranian crude either. And I think that's bothering the United States. But what's so funny here is, you know, this decision really seems to cut against, and this, I say the same as sort of would apply to the decision to remove this preference for Turkey, cuts against many of what President Trump has been saying are his priorities in the Asia-Pacific region. I mean, he importantly renamed it the Indo-Pacific, right? I mean, it was all about trying to figure out ways to move the sort of democracies and the democratic allies of the U.S. and Asia behind the United States and against China here. And India is looking at this decision and saying, what the heck? I mean, I actually think it's really not great for Narendra Modi, their prime minister, who's up for re-election in a few weeks. And this really is going to tap into, I think, the simmering anti-American sentiment.
But don't you think that might actually help him? Because he ran as kind of a Donald Trump. He's a nationalist. He's a hardline right winger.
Well, you know, it actually, he may be able to spin it to his advantage, but in a way that wouldn't be beneficial to the United States in the end.
My point.
Namely, you know, we hit them with steel and aluminum tariffs, and they decided to sort of bite their lip and take it as opposed to spiraling the relationship down. Now there's a pressure, hey, and that really would hurt the United States in ways that giving away a few, you know, $100 million in trade concessions to them does not. So it might prompt a more negative response from them. And on the Turkish side, the reason Trump is doing this is ostensibly because they are not buying Patriot missile systems from us. We had been pushing them, saying, look, as a NATO country, you've got to buy American weapon systems, or at the very least, you can't be buying Russian missile systems, which is sort of incompatible with the NATO goals of basically containing Russia. That you're, that's a real you know, weakness inside of the alliance now if you buy these things. And they refused a few days ago. And I think this is just the latest in a whole list of items, be it the Turkey wanting the extradition of Fethullah Gulen, or the U.S. wanting their pastor freed, or our support of the YPG. All these little political issues have this tendency, at least the past few years, to get become bargaining chips in the U.S.-Turkey relationship. So this is just the last one.
Does it look to you like Turkey's moving toward Russia? Because, I mean, you know, Donald Trump decided to pull us out of Syria after talking with Erdogan from Turkey. And really, I get it that Turkey has an issue with the Kurds and they have a border with Syria. But were there other actors involved in that were being channeled through Mr. Erdogan? How is it that Trump, you know, does exactly what Erdogan tells him to do, and then the government is imposing these sanctions? I mean, is Trump unaware of what's going on here, or is this coming out of the White House?
Well, you could look at it as, look, the U.S. and Russia are sort of competing for preferential treatment within Turkey, and the U.S. is sort of realizing it's losing here, and it's saying, fine, if you're not going to be so close to us, then we're going to pull back. But much like the India situation sort of creates a possible risk of us suffering more of an economic punishment for ending the preferential status, I would argue you might see the same thing with Turkey insofar as, you know, if we're trying to get them to come back to being a close trade partner with the United States, the kind of country that would buy Patriot missile systems, maybe on the next round of missile orders or whatever the new generation of technology will be in a few years, we're not incentivizing that by making the trade relationship, you know, more hostile. And in fact, this may open the door for Russia to expand its connections with Turkey, because now the U.S. terms of doing business are, by comparison, worse than they were before. So again, do we know if
Trump is aware of these policies?
There does seem to, and I've, other commentators have noticed this, but there does seem to be this trend with Trump where he looks at these small grievances on trade and he sets policy around them at the expense of all of his other stated sort of geopolitical goals, whether it's bringing India, Australia, and Japan together with the U.S. to counter China, but then, you know, souring the relationship with India over relatively petty matters. Yeah. Or in the case of Turkey, hey, we want to expand our trade relations. They wanted to triple, I think, the bilateral trade with, you know, Trump and Erdogan had agreed to this. And then you have a policy here which it doesn't look like there's any scenario in which, you know, ending preferential trade status is going to boost the relationship. And now Russia perhaps has a new market. So again, it's cutting off your nose.
So now, in addition, the EU is now starting to push back on Viktor Orban. He is the hardcore right-wing nationalist who has taken over Hungary. What's going on there?
Well, it's tough because he's part of this alliance, the center-right alliance of the European People's Party, which includes dozens of parties from all over Europe, and is pretty powerful, includes Angela Merkel's party. And they've been looking at this rising authoritarianism, basically, in Hungary and saying this is against all of our values. You know, Viktor Orban in particular has been dissing Juncker, the head of the European Commission, who's a member of this party, and alleging all these anti-Semitic things that, you know, George Soros is backing some immigration scheme. And I think finally they've said enough. The question is, they've allowed this sort of cancerous segment of their own party to grow for so long. At this point, does it have much of an effect to give them the boot or just boost Orban and his arguments in the long run?
So it's kind of a debate over, like, the Republican Party, what do we do about Steve King?
I think that's an apt comparison.
Okay, great. Luke Vargas with Talk Media News. Thank you, Luke.
Thank you, Tom.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.